Right now in Russia, we've learned recently they're talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and Navy getting involved and doing some exercises on the to get prepared. And when they're talking about these type of weapons, especially non-strategic nuclear weapons, is that a sign of escalation or is that a sign of warning the West from what they're doing right now in Ukraine?
When Russia initiated the special military operation, the Russian leadership, especially Vladimir Putin, made it very clear that Russia would not tolerate any NATO intervention into the Ukrainian issue. And they said that if NATO intervenes, that could lead to direct engagement between Russia and NATO, and that that could involve all the weapons at Russia's disposal. Since that time, Russia's repeated this warning to NATO. Every time NATO crosses a red line, sends modern equipment, threatens to send F-16 fighters, sends Storm Shadow missiles, gives a green light for Storm Shadow missiles to be used against Russian strategic targets, threatens to deploy NATO troops on Ukrainian soil. All of these are red lines. And Russia has finally said, I don't know what part of we won't tolerate this you don't understand. And so the exercise is not just a warning, it's a statement. Russia has these weapons and they will use them. As Vladimir Putin has said, the decision has already been made. There's not going to be a phone call. There's not going to be a discussion. There's not going to be a dialogue. When Russian doctrine, allows nuclear weapons to be used, they will be used. And the first time the West will know about it is when NATO decision-making centers are ignited in a fireball of, nuclear holocaust. The Russians aren't joking. They're not bluffing. Now, this isn't something new. They've been saying all along, stay out of Ukraine. You don't get to make Ukraine part of NATO. We're not going to allow it. It is an existential issue for us, one which we will use all the weapons at our disposal, including nuclear weapons. I think what the Russians are also saying is a signal to the United States that if Great Britain, for instance, allows the green lighting of Storm Shadow missiles to be used against Russia strategically, that Great Britain will pay a price. If France deploys troops on Ukrainian soil, France will pay a price. That doesn't necessarily mean that the United States will pay a price, but if the United States wants to, Vladimir Putin reminded the world today during his Victory Day speech, the Russian strategic nuclear forces ready to go into action at a moment's notice. This is where we're at. Now, the question is, will the West take this seriously? Right now, we have a whole bunch of people in the West that say Russia's bluffing. Russia doesn't bluff. This isn't a bluff. And as Vladimir Putin said, the decision's already been made. So maybe the West thinks that Russia's going to, call them on the phone, warn them, do something first. No, the decision's already been made. So if the West, believing Russia bluffs, disregards the Russian warnings, and does that which Russia said is not permissible, I don't think anybody should be surprised when these tactical nuclear weapons start detonating above NATO, French, and British decision-making centers and troop concentrations.
If you remember, before this conflict in Ukraine started, they were talking about that Russia is bluffing. They're not doing anything. And when this attack started, this special military operation started, they said, "Oh, we got surprised. We are so surprised why Russia did that." And they're doing the same right now. And they're saying that Russia is bluffing, as you've mentioned. Are they really not willing to learn anything from what's going on, from what we have witnessing so far in Ukraine?
Look, there are no more Russian experts in the United States, and there are no more Russian experts in Europe. What you have are a class of academic and political elites that have cut their teeth on the Russia of the 1990s, where it wasn't important to understand Russia, just to understand how to exploit Russia, how to dominate Russia politically, economically. Vladimir Putin's rise to power wasn't ever studied. Why did this happen? Who is Vladimir Putin? And what does he seek to accomplish? it was always seen as an insult by the West, who thought that they had Russia under control, that they thought they had broken Russia down into a containable space. And how dare Vladimir Putin come up and say, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. And so people have been resentful of Putin. So they've sought to trivialize him, sought to trivialize Russia, to oversimplify Russia in the form of a single individual. They have been articulating policies designed not to respect the reality of Russia, but rather to operate as if the Russia they want, they dream of existing, actually existed. The more Vladimir Putin stays in power, the greater the space is between the fantasy of the West and the reality of Russia. The experts we currently have advising our political leadership in the United States and in Europe have both feet planted in the fantasy of what they want Russia to be, and they have no ability to comprehend the reality of what Russia is. As a result, they honestly believe that Russia is bluffing because they don't understand Russia. You know, there's an old saying, I use it all the time, that you can't solve a problem that you haven't accurately defined first, because if you don't accurately define the problem, whatever you're solving isn't the problem. It's something to something else. These advisors are trying to implement policies that are based upon a problem that exists in the fantasy world only. The real problem is in reality. And therefore, the policies that they're implementing have nothing to do with reality, and therefore, lead us down, torturous paths away from, truth, away from, the ability to resolve conflict. They may believe that Russia is bluffing because they don't understand Russia, because they're ignorant about Russia, and their leadership is similarly ignorant and reliant upon policy given to them by people who are, frankly speaking, unqualified to make policy about Russia. But that's the situation we find ourselves in. And so they are deluding themselves. They are deceiving themselves, and they're putting the people they're responsible for protecting in a very precarious situation.
When it comes to the policymakers in the United States, considering Republicans, we hear a much clearer voice from them than the Democratic Party. We had Hakeem Jeffries, he had an interview with 60 Minutes. He said that we are going to put troops on the ground in Ukraine. And on the other hand, Biden says we are not willing to do that. Different mixed voices coming from the Biden administration and Democratic Party. Do you think, in your opinion, are they trying to intimidate Russia? We know that it doesn't work. It didn't work for this conflict in Ukraine. Why they're trying to do, in your opinion?
Well, when you're dealing with American politicians, you have to evaluate what they say from two different perspectives. One is a foreign policy, national security perspective, meaning, what are they actually talking about? Troops on the ground? Does that make sense? How does it resolve things, et cetera, et cetera? But oftentimes that aspect is subordinated to how the statement is perceived from a domestic political consideration. We're in a very contentious election year for the presidency of the United States and control of the United States Congress. And so everything one of these politicians says has to be evaluated from the standpoint of how it plays amongst the electorate. Amongst the various constituencies in the United States. And so when you hear somebody like Hakeem Jeffries make a statement like that, remember, he is not a policymaker. Who is Hakeem Jeffries? No one listens to him. He's the House minority leader. He doesn't even get to set the agenda of the House. If he calls Lloyd Austin, Lloyd Austin won't pick it up because Hakeem Jeffries is not in the chain of command. He's a nobody. And so for him to make that statement, you have to say, well, why are you making that statement? And what he's trying to do is appease a certain part of the electorate that is demanding more action by the United States and Europe in defense of Ukraine. And so he makes these statements. But the reality is, again, he is in no position to do anything with that statement. Joe Biden's not listening to him because Joe Biden has to deal with, reality. And Joe Biden has said that we don't want to put troops on the ground because Joe Biden recognizes that that will lead to a general war that will be devastating, you know, at a minimum, devastating economically. And if you go back to, you know, the advice given by James Carville in 1992 to then candidate Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid, meaning that don't sit there and talk about foreign policy and talk about national security policy and talking about this environmental policy. What the American voter wants to hear on election day is economic policy. What are you going to do to put money in their respective pockets? And Biden knows that a war would be highly unpopular, that while Americans are in favor of supporting Ukraine, they're not in favor of sending American forces to Ukraine. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what they say, because Russia's not listening anymore. You know, there's a price you pay when you seek to isolate Russia, when you cease to engage with Russia. Russia's not a minor country that will allow itself to be contained and put into a, you know, a back room and have the door shut and the lights turned out. Russia's a major player on the world stage today, and Russia has aligned itself with other major players like China, to a lesser extent India, but you know, much of the global South is aligned with Russia. Russia is a major member of the BRICS Forum, which is an emerging form of geopolitical significance that rivals, in some cases surpasses, that of the Group of Seven, which was previously the most powerful form of this type. Russia this year is hosting the BRICS summit in Kazan in October. This will be a earth-shaking event. When Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov travels around the world, he's welcomed not only with open arms and with respect by people who want to listen to him because they treat Russia as a very relevant player on the global stage. Vladimir Putin's the most highly respected leader in the world today in terms of a global audience. We have stopped interacting with Russia. Nobody's calling Ambassador Anatoly Antonov and saying, hey, let's have meetings. In theory, given what's going on in the world today and Russia's role in much of this, Anatoly Antonov should be the busiest man in Washington, D.C. Everybody should be wanting to talk to him. I want to talk to him, because he's the Russian ambassador. I'd like to know what Russia's thinking. I'd like to know what he's thinking. Nobody's talking to him. The defense attaché, again, should be the busiest military man in Washington, D.C., going to the, to the Pentagon, going to, various meetings. His officers shouldn't be getting any sleep at night. They should be attending functions, interacting, taking notes, trying to pass on insight into Russian military thinking, et cetera, so that that insight can be taken back to policymakers who will be better informed about what Russia's up to, what their intentions are, and have policies to reflect that. In Moscow, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, every floor, the lights should be on all night long. Because the various desk officers should be married to their desk, answering the phone, writing up memorandum, trying to staff ideas, because Russia's that important. And in many cases, they are. The people that are interfacing with the world other than the United States and Europe are very busy. But the America desk, the European desk, the lights are out. When the guys show up in the morning, they just bring their coffee in, they sit there and they stare at a blank screen and they drink their coffee because the phones ain't ringing because America and Europe, they're not talking to them. And at some point in time, these guys are highly trained individuals with a lot of experience. The Africa desk is going to go, hey, we're really busy over here. Could you like send some guys this way? And the head of the America desk goes, yeah, well, you might as well take, 50% of my guys, and the European desk kicks them up, and they all go over there, and now they're doing real diplomacy. And the other guys just sit there and while their time away, because it's not, and diplomacy is a muscle. It's a muscle that has to be used. I'd like to make it a muscle that's well exercised, goes to the gym often, you feed it well, it's nutrition, gets bigger. But when it's not used, it just sits there, it atrophies. And the diplomatic muscle that connects Russia with the United States is atrophied. It's non-existent. The same thing with the military relationships that I used to be part of building. They're non-existent. So what the Russians have done is said, we're not going to just sit here and do nothing. We're going to move forward. Russia right now is heavily engaged around the world leading the world in many of these geopolitical issues, economic, military, political. And they're doing it in a way that the United States doesn't factor in. They don't care. I mean, it's not that they don't care, but when America makes itself irrelevant, it becomes irrelevant. And so Russia doesn't, use, I can guarantee you that if there was an American desk officer on Africa who interfaced with the Russian desk officer on Africa about issues of the Sahel, that if they were talking, that would be a very busy phone line. We'd be calling the Russians up, asking for clarification, saying, why are you doing this? How, da 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 da. Very busy. It's not happening. So Russia's doing what they do in Africa without American involvement because America has opted out. Europe has opted out. And so Russia literally doesn't care. And this is a very dangerous thing because it means that we have no influence anymore. That where we might have legitimate national security concerns or foreign policy concerns or economic concerns, that we should be articulating to the Russians so that in an effort to maintain peace and security, they modify their posture, just like we would modify if they called us up. That's what diplomacy does. It seeks to avoid confrontation through compromise, while defending your respective position as strongly as possible. Diplomacy is the art of the compromise. How do you compromise and still achieve what you ultimately want to achieve? Well, we're not doing it anymore. The Russians are just doing what they want. We no longer matter. And this is a very, very scary thing. If the average American citizen would reflect on this for a moment, and once they stop being scared, they should be enraged because, we have a government that's not serving the interests of the American people very well. It doesn't serve anybody to be isolated from Russia at this point in time.
Scott, there is an article in Politico. It says, too little, too late, this new aid to Ukraine. And do you think the Biden administration is getting to the point that they say the case of Ukraine is done and even Odessa is gone? And let's, but they don't want to accept it. They want to transfer it to the next administration. They don't want to accept that they lost this war in Ukraine, this conflict in Ukraine, and they want to transfer it to the next administration, whoever going to be in office in Washington.
I mean, in theory, yeah, that makes sense. But again, I come back to the point, who cares? I don't anymore. Why? No one's paying attention to Washington, D.C., not in Russia. And that's the only one that counts. The Russians have made a decision that people need to reflect on the fact that some things have happened. Russia, prior to last month, Russia was still leaving the door open for negotiation. They were engaged in positional warfare, active defense that was designed to preserve the territory they had, win back the Russian territory, but not dramatically change the map of Ukraine beyond that which has already been changed. They were conceivably prepared to talk to Zelensky and his government, even though Zelensky had made it impossible to do so. The Russians are saying, we leave the door open. But today, those conditions no longer exist. Marshal Shoigu has said that Russia has changed, transitioned over from active defense to the offense. That means they're no longer in the business of, not making radical changes on the map. They're in the business of making radical changes on the map. They're in the business of acquiring territory beyond simply the goal of defeating the Ukrainian army. This is a big deal. It means that whatever Russia was willing to negotiate or have on the table before this decision is no longer on the table because Russia has now decided they're going to alter the reality on the battlefield. And two, they've put Zelensky, former President Poroshenko, Chief of Staff, Yermak, I think it is, and then Danilov, another advisor, and other intelligence officials are all on a wanted list right now. You don't negotiate with criminals. So that basically what Russia has said is, we don't negotiate with these people, and that's where we are today. If that's the Russian position, I mean, and how does the United States respond? We support a peace conference in Switzerland where everybody's invited but Russia. How do you make yourself irrelevant by talking about peace in a conflict where Russia is the major participant, but you don't allow Russia to participate? And meanwhile, Russia says, we don't care about your peace conference anymore. We don't care about anything other than winning, and we're going to win on our terms. So Politico can have their headlines, they can have their stupid writers write what they want, because it's you know, one of the reasons why you're bringing it up is it represents a fundamental change from the stance that Politico had been taking. It means Politico claims to be waking up, but they're waking up to nothing, because Politico, like every other Western media outlet, makes its living off of reporting what's coming out of Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. has made itself irrelevant. So the reporting on irrelevancy. If Politico wanted to be relevant, they should be in Moscow right now, knocking on Vladimir Putin's door and saying, hey, can we interview? We want to know what you're thinking. We want to know what Shoigu's thinking. We want to know what Lavrov's thinking. We want to know what the relevant people are thinking, because those are the only opinions that matter right now. Because Russia no longer cares about America, no longer cares about Europe when it comes to its, you know, these decisions of vital importance. So I don't care what Politico says. It's irrelevant. I don't even waste my time reading this stuff anymore, to be honest, because if they're not talking to Russian sources, they're only talking to ignorance. And I don't need an ignorant journalist to report on ignorant statements made by ignorant people. That's not what I'm willing to waste my time on. I'd rather hear from relevant people. I want to know what Vladimir Putin, that's why I listen to his speeches. That's why I listen to his inauguration address. That's why I listen to his speech on Victory Day, and I'll listen to his speeches going forward. He dissolved, you know, his entire government has resigned. Now that's pro forma, but this time is different. It looks like he's going to put a new government in. I'd like to know why. I'd like to know what he's thinking. Why is he picking the people he wants? What does that say about the future? He's made some statements about, you know, the future of Russia will be determined by the heroes of the special military operation. That's an important statement. What does that say about the old oligarch class? What does it say about the Russian governors and mayors out there who had distanced themselves from this conflict? They're out. Who's in? Russia is being even more radically transformed into a Russia defined by Russia, not defined by others. And remember what I said about the people that don't—they are so-called Russian experts. They're so far removed from reality right now because Russia is going through another important transition. They're not even focused on, because all they say is that Vladimir Putin's not the legitimate leader of Russia because he ran a sham election. If that's your belief, then no one's going to listen to you, because literally you are the personification of stupidity.
Do you think these changes that Vladimir Putin is applying in his government, is that related to that these new regions getting involved in the Russian election?
Look, the percentage of the population that's that these new regions possess is not politically relevant. The new regions are more symbolic, and I don't mean that to be trivialized, that they're real and it's a real issue. It's about the existential survival of Russia. But, you know, that conflict is already won. Putin doesn't have to worry about that. His military is winning. Those populations are solidly behind him. So he doesn't have to do anything to appease them. They're already solidly behind him. Putin is actually reaching back into the interior of Russia, where in regions far away from this conflict, you have governors and you have mayors who have not been supportive of this, because they are people who are part of a political elite that has linkage. You know, their lineage goes back to the 1990s. They came into power through corrupt means. They achieved their economic wealth by, you know, by robbing the citizens, you know, whether it's through coupon schemes or, you know, other extra legal activity. These are people who rose to the top. Vladimir Putin had no choice but to tolerate their existence, because you can't purge everybody at once. You have to maintain some sort of economic stability and political stability. And so he tolerated their existence. He worked to get them to operate within a system that he designed, but they still existed and they still resisted and they were still whispering behind his back and they were still not supporting what is an existential conflict. Vladimir Putin has taken this conflict in the Donbass, in the new Russian territories, and he's used it as a defining feature. You're literally either with Russia on this or you're against Russia. And his statement in his inauguration address and the statement on Victory Day underscored this, that the future of Russia will be defined by leaders who sacrificed in this war, either serving on the front lines or supporting this war from a defense industry standpoint or other standpoints. But people who were on the fence or silent, they're going to be purged. And this is a defining moment for that. So in that way, the new territories, the Donbass, Kherson, Zaporizhia, are a major factor in what Vladimir Putin's doing, because it's that conflict that has allowed Putin to mobilize the patriotism of Russia and use it to his benefit. And the war is a defining moment. One of the important things about Victory Day today is the linkage that Vladimir Putin has successfully made between the emotional connection that the Russian people have with their history, with the 27 million dead of World War II who sacrificed their lives to save Russia, to save the Soviet Union. And today, where the special military operation is seen as an existential struggle against the collective West that's seeking the strategic defeat of Russia. And the Russian people have made this direct linkage so that they are the heirs of this most worthy generation. And this is their moment. And so they are, they are stepping up to the plate. There's a song that it's been around for a while. I think it's called The Crane. Beautiful song. About Russian soldiers, but it's linked to the Second World War. But on the occasion of this Victory Day, it's been re-released, and it's sung by participants of the Special Military Operation frontline soldiers. And each one of them has a portrait of their relative, the Immortal Regiment, their relative who served in World War II. And the beauty of this song is the linkage that is made between the Second World War and today. The Russians believe this. It's in their heart. It's in their soul. It's not propaganda. It's real. And if we in the West don't recognize it, then we don't know anything about Russia, and we'll never be able to come up with policies that will be acceptable to Russia. And as Russia's already said, we don't matter anymore. They don't care. They've moved on.
Olaf Scholz says that May 8th is the day of liberation of Germany and the world from the tyranny of National Socialism. This day reminds us we must protect and defend peace. Is Germany learning, or has Germany learned anything from the history, from what we've seen so far?
Are there individual Germans who have learned something from history? Of course. The danger of painting a nation or a people with a single brush is that there are those who will take offense or take umbrage of what you've said. So for all the Germans there who have learned the lessons of history, first, the question I have is, why aren't you in the streets today screaming at the top of your lungs to stop the policies of Olaf Scholz and the German government today, which appear to have forgotten the lessons of history? Why do you think it's okay to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine to fight Russians when you sent Panthers and Tigers before, and that was a failed effort? Why do you support a Banderist-leaning government in Ukraine when Bandera was an ally of Adolf Hitler, and the Ukrainian ultranationalists that he led participated in the slaughter of Jews and Poles and Russians? Never again doesn't mean never again, does it? Because it's happening now, and yet you're allowing it to happen. You're Germans who owe the world. You owe the world the duty of making sure it never happens again. And yet it's happening again because of you. Olaf Scholz hasn't learned anything. When Olaf Scholz and the German government refuses to allow Russians to participate in the ceremonies of the liberation of the, marking the liberation of the Nazi death camps, the concentration camps, it means you've learned nothing. I just ask all Germans to go to Berlin, go to the parliament, go to the Reichstag, the former Reichstag, now it's the Bundestag, and go out and look at Tiergarten and look at the plinths that are set up there, and tell me what kind of tank is on that plinth. Is it an American M4 Sherman? Is it a Crusader from the British? No, it's a Soviet T-34-85. Those are the tanks that the Soviet Union used to defeat Nazi Germany, to capture Berlin, to destroy the odious ideology of Adolf Hitler. Those tanks are there for a reason, because your city was taken by the Russians. You haven't learned anything if today you have the gall to stand up and criticize Russia for taking down the progeny of Nazi Germany, which of course is what Ukraine is. And you know it. You know it, Germany. You know it. You have the damn, gravesite of Bandera on your soil. On your soil. Dig his body up, cut it into a million pieces, and scatter it around the world. Nobody should be ever allowed to visit that site. His is not a memory that should be allowed to exist. Eliminate him from the world. But you let it happen. You let people come. You let the Ukrainian ambassador come and speak kindly of Bandera, the ambassador to Germany. What are you, Germany? I don't mean to be cruel, but I'm going to say it. Scratch a German, you get a Nazi. And if I go to Germany today and scratch you, I'll get the same blood that bled in the soil of Russia. I'm pissed at you, Germany. You want to know why? Because on this day, my wife cried. You want to know why my wife cried? Because her father's cousin, 18 years of age, died fighting Nazi Germany in Poland, and his body is buried in an unmarked grave. Other relatives are buried in other places in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians are toppling the memorials to the sacrifice they made. My relatives on my wife's side. We lost people in Berlin. And you're sitting here pretending it didn't happen. Germany can go to hell, frankly speaking, because they are no better than the people that walked the face of the earth 80 years ago, wearing the swastika. You haven't learned anything, Germany. You haven't learned a damn thing. You should never be a nation talking about militarization. You don't deserve to have an army. You are lucky to be around today. The Morgenthau Plan should have been implemented based upon what you're doing today. There was a hesitancy on the part of the Soviet Union to allow Germany to reunify because they said too many things are left unresolved. We haven't really thought through this piece. What happens when you bring the two pieces back together? Because Russia knew, the Soviet Union knew, they have 27 million dead because of a unified Germany. Do you really want to bring them back together again without first deciding how this is going to happen? What are the rules of the game? Can we trust them to have a viable economy, linked to a viable industry that's linked to Germany's active participation in a military alliance that claims to be defensive in nature, but within 1 year of the collapse of the Soviet Union, violated its pledge not to move one inch eastward. And Germany is part and parcel of this. Germany should have said no. Germany should never allow the expansion of NATO. Germany should have stood up in Brussels and said, one inch eastward means exactly that, and we will not tolerate it because we have done this before. We marched on the east. We committed genocide. We committed war crimes, and we remember this, and we will never allow it to happen again. But Germany is allowing it to happen again because they have learned nothing. They have learned nothing. So I grew up in Germany. I have to tell you, I mean, I loved it. The German people were nice people. I grew up in the 70s. What does that mean, growing up in the 70s? That means that the people that were 50 and 60 years old, I'm 62 today. So there were people there who were still healthy and viable. That meant they served in Nazi army. That means they grew up in Nazi times. And I was looking at them saying, what nice people. But at one time, they had an armband on their shoulders and they stood in a parade in Nuremberg or elsewhere with their arms in the air shouting, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. No, the German people aren't nice people. The German people are a scourge on the planet. And if they continue down this path, if they haven't learned the lessons of history, and Russia is compelled because of their actions, to teach the ultimate lesson. I will not shed a tear when Russian tanks roll through Berlin and take that city down for the last time, because Germany doesn't deserve to exist. What does Germany stand for? Does it stand for peace? No, it doesn't stand for peace. They're building Taurus missiles that they want to send to the Ukrainians, to the Nazis. They're building missiles to send to the Nazis to strike the Russians. That means they haven't learned anything at all. Scratch a German, get a Nazi. Prove me wrong.
It seems that General Armageddon is back on mission. And do we know where he has been and what he's going to do right now?
I mean, you can only put two and two together. He was dispatched to Africa, where he carried out several meetings in Africa. This was done at the same time that the Wagner private military contract team, Wagner Group, was transitioned away from being private military contractors into being subordinated to the Ministry of Defense. Wagner today is called the Africa Corps, and they are operating throughout Africa. Is Surovikin linked to them? We know that Surovikin had relations with Prigozhin, Yevgeny Prigozhin, the former head of Wagner. We know that he was designated as the go-to man within the Russian military to facilitate logistical support for Wagner during very critical periods in the war, the fighting for Bakhmut. When Prigozhin was claiming that there was artillery starvation and he needed stuff, Surovikin was meant to be the man who facilitated that. We know that Surovikin came under investigation in the aftermath of Prigozhin revolt because of these links and the perception that he didn't do enough to stand up to Prigozhin's revolt. There was a period of time where people claimed that he was under house arrest, but he's a very capable man. He's a very honorable man, and Russia needs capable and honorable people. So he was removed from the special military operation and given a new assignment. I think it's an assignment that built on the good relations that he enjoyed with Wagner. And there were many in Wagner who were reticent about signing these contracts, about subordinating themselves to the Ministry of Defense. There was a lot of private economic contract-based activity taking place between Wagner and the various nations that were outside of the purview of the Russian government. And these all needed to be brought under control. And so Surovikin was the man tapped to do this, I believe. The Russians haven't formally said this. There's been nobody who said exactly what his title was. I could be 100% wrong. He could have done something completely different. But my assessment is that based upon the dots that exist on the map, that he was sent to Africa to separate himself from the special military operation, get out of the political controversy that existed because of Prigozhin and Prigozhin's revolt, and B, to take advantage of the connectivity he had with Wagner to reset Russia's presence in Africa. The Russian presence in Africa is of strategic importance to Russia. Vladimir Putin would not have assigned him this job had he not thought highly of Surovikin's capabilities and his loyalty to Russia. And now that he's proven that, he's back, and we'll see. I can't predict the future, but what I can say is this. Vladimir Putin said in his inaugural address that the future of Russia will be determined by those heroes of the special military operation. And there is no greater hero of the special military operation than General Surovikin. So we'll see if there's a role he gets to play in the Russian government going forward. He's a man that is deeply respected, has high, tremendously high professionalism and capabilities, a proven record of performance. I don't believe that his time in Russia is finished.
How the activities of Russia and China are connected in Africa?
I mean, both nations are sovereign nations, so they have their own independent policies, but they are also nations that are linked through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, linked through BRICS, and linked through strong bilateral relations. There are also nations that define their current level of interaction by their collective opposition to the rules-based international order premised on American hegemony. Africa is sort of the last great frontier in the great game being played out by by the rules-based international order and this new Russian-Chinese law-based international order. China has tremendous economic inroads into Africa. The Belt and Roads Initiative has made its presence known, but Russia has a tremendous security relationship, a respected security relationship that dates back to the times of the Soviet Union when Russia helped many of these nations in their anti-colonial stances. So there's a lot of goodwill in Africa with Russia. And I think Russia and China are finding the perfect mix. To give you an example of what the potential of this is, Niger, which of course had a coup in July of 2023, ousted the pro-French government had recently just kicked out not only the French troops, but now the American troops that were there. The Africa Corps is on the ground in Niger. At least 60, probably more. 60 have arrived at base 101, which used to be an American base outside of the Nigerian capital of Niamey. And so Russians are moving into the former American bases. Meanwhile, Niger, which is also an oil producing country, had been told that they can't build a pipeline to export their oil. But the Chinese build it. But China has come in and built a pipeline connecting Niger with a port facility in the neighboring nation of Benin. And so now Niger, which previously, could produce, they had the potential to produce up to 200,000 barrels a day, but they were limited by what their domestic consumption market was, around 30,000 barrels a day. They're now exporting 110,000 barrels a day. That's bringing in income that the government didn't have, income that will be used to create social programs to raise the standard of living of the people of Niger. This is a direct result of the Russian-Chinese cooperation and their cooperative approach. And I think you're going to see that model repeat itself throughout Africa as the United States and the former European colonial powers are sent packing, and Russia and China move in and assert a collective presence on the continent.
It's so amazing to see how Russia and China are connected, as you've mentioned, in Africa, in the Middle East. And when Antony Blinken went to China to convince Chinese not to help Russia in the conflict in the war in Ukraine, and in my opinion, if there is somebody in the world who wants Russia win more than Vladimir Putin, would be Xi, because he knows what does it mean for this conflict between Russia and NATO, and then maybe the conflict between China and NATO in Taiwan. What's your take on this?
Look, Russia and China have had a strategic relationship for some time now. But I would say before the special military operation, that was a relationship that was more defined by the fact that Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping got along well. They were truly friends. They enjoyed each other's company. I mean, you just look at the videos. I think Vladimir Putin had invited Xi Jinping into Russia and on his birthday and was cooking pancakes for him. And you could just see the two men interacting as the kind of personal, intimate interaction between friends. And when you have friendly leaders of that nature, that sets the course. But there was a lot of institutional resistance in Russia and in China, because historically, Russia and China have not necessarily been aligned. Even during the early years of the Cold War, it was a strained relationship as the Chinese Communist Party struggled for dominance with the Soviet Communist Party. And You know, they ended up having a break in relations that the United States exploited through Nixon going to China. And we've been trying to drive a wedge between the two of them ever since. You know, but the friendship between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping helped overcome that. But when Russia moved into Ukraine, initiated the special military operation, you know, China was not 100% on board. There's no doubt that they were pre-briefed that something like this could happen. Vladimir Putin did go to Beijing on February 4th of 2022 at the opening of the Beijing Winter Olympics. They had a meeting. He had a meeting with Xi Jinping where they issued a 5,000-word joint statement. Understand, these joint statements just don't write themselves. It's the byproduct of months of preparation. And so Russia had been diplomatically engaging with China in the lead up to the initiation of the special military operation. And what they did is they said, we are together to oppose the rules-based international order and to assert this new law-based international order that's based upon Russia and China working towards a trans-Eurasian economic union kind of thing. But it was still economic in nature. It spoke about the needs of, respecting national security interests of each other. But when Russia moved into Ukraine militarily, the Chinese were confronted with the inconsistency of the Russian action as it related to their Westphalian principles of non-intervention that China had, seized upon previously as sort of the cornerstone of their policy. Of course, the Chinese would, because they can't encourage outside powers to intervene in Taiwan. They can't encourage outside powers to intervene in Tibet. They can't encourage outside powers to intervene in Western China. So China, has a policy of strict non-intervention, and now Russia has intervened. The Chinese, they had a problem there of trying to square these two things. They were still friendly with Russia, but they couldn't jump on board, and so. But this hesitancy was seized upon by the West as evidence that China was opposed to the Russian invasion. But the problem is that the Chinese were sitting there looking at Russia and why they went into Ukraine. And they said, well, wait a minute, the same pressures being put on Russia are being put on us in regards to Taiwan. And that if Russia loses, if Russia is defeated on this, the same actors that are defeating Russia would then feel empowered to act against us on Taiwan. And so the Chinese made the decision that the Russians couldn't be allowed to be defeated. At first, the Chinese worked with them economically, making sure that Russia had an economic lifeline to overcome the sanctions that were imposed on it. But once Russia became economically stable, China bore witness to the fact that the West poured in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of military aid to sustain this conflict. And all China had to do is listen to the debates. We're sending too many weapons to Ukraine. We don't have enough weapons to defend Taiwan. And the Chinese are like, hey, man, what are you doing talking about defending Taiwan? is there something going on we don't know about? And the answer is yes. They're talking about a war in Taiwan. And so from the Chinese perspective, it became essential that Russia win, that to the best way of defending Taiwan is to ensure a decisive Russian victory. And so China is firmly committed to that, to the extent that China is providing military assistance. First of all, Russia doesn't really need direct military assistance. Russia has a large, vibrant military industry, but that industry does require components. And China does provide critical components that are used in the manufacture of specific weapon systems in Russia. And China's more than happy to make that happen. It's irritated the West to no extent, because the West now has come to the realization that Russian defense industry is fully mobilized, and it makes it impossible for the West to prevail against Russia. And so they're blaming China for this. China doesn't care. That's the point people need to understand. It doesn't matter how many times Emmanuel Macron and Ursula von der Leyen sit there and talk about, China needs to do this or that. And the other thing, the fact is, none of them have any leverage. Remember, Ursula von der Leyen went follow on the heels of Olaf Scholz and his visit to to China, and she was sent packing. She's irrelevant. She wasn't met as a as anybody of notice, and they sent her back, through the tourist lane. And Schultz was told in no uncertain terms that, we don't care. We view your de-risking as delinking. If you want to delink, we'll delink. But meanwhile, all the German business leaders were there telling Schultz, shut up. VW said, the only part of our business that makes money, that allows us to stay in business, is our automotive industry in China. And you want us to de-risk it, to pull out? Pull out to what? There's a vacuum back here in Germany because of your stupidity. Because of your policies, we can't produce automobiles in Europe anymore. We can only produce them in China. That's the only place we make money. And all the other industries went, we have the same story here. And so Schultz had to shut up. And the realization is that Germany can't exist as an industrial state without China. The same holds true for the rest of Europe. And China waltzes in knowing this. Does China want Europe to impose sanctions? No, they don't, because that would be somewhat disruptive to their economic engine. But can the Chinese engine, it's the same thing. Let's put it this way. I think there's a Chinese proverb that a typhoon is different if you're an island or if you're the ocean. All right, so sanctions are a typhoon. And if you're a nation that is economically vulnerable, you're an island. And you view that storm as a very big deal. But when you're a nation like China, who is the ocean, that storm's just one of these little hiccups over here that will eventually go away. The ocean will continue. China is the ocean. And all these sanctions being threatened, whether it's by Europe, by the United States, they're just a typhoon in the giant Pacific Ocean. Yeah, it's a little inconvenient right now, but eventually it will go away and the ocean will be there forever. And that's the Chinese approach right now. They just don't care about the West, but they are 100% behind Russia on this one. And you'll see this. Vladimir Putin is going to be going to China later this month, I think next week even. His first state visit after moving forward. And he's talked about this, his new term as being sort of a revolution, where we're looking at a new Russian revolution. Something's dramatic is happening, and it's going to be defined not only by how he reshapes Russia internally, but also how Russia relates with the rest of the world. And I think you're going to see some bold statements being made by Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping that seek to transition the Russian-Chinese relationships away from a relationship defined by two leaders liking each other into a relationship defined by two nations who are strategically aligned with one another.
In my recent talk with Paul Carrick Roberts, he said he doesn't understand why there is no alliance, military alliance, between Russia, China, and Iran, because that would hugely benefit the peace in the world. Do you think, are we already having some sort of de facto alliance between these three countries?
Well, there is a de facto alliance, and it's stronger than any written alliance. As soon as you commit to a treaty and you commit to national obligations that are in writing, the treaty actually becomes very self-limiting, because now you are boxing in your relationships with strict definitions, strict obligations. You must do this. And it limits your flexibility, especially in a changing world. Understand that today, the world that exists today, the problems we're talking about, this time next year, we're going to be talking about completely different problems. Okay, the world's changing. So you sign a treaty today that's designed to quantify a relationship based upon modern realities, the treaty will be out of date in a year. You'll have to come back and renegotiate things. You'll have to write, addendums to the treaty. But that means you have to engage. And the thing about that is, too, is that no relationship is perfect. No relationship is perfect. Every nation, even, nations that are ruled with strong leaders like Russia, China, and Iran, they still are very much influenced by the will of the people, meaning that you need the will of the people. So there will be situations where Iran expected Russia to do X, Y, and Z, and Russia didn't. And the will of the people will be moving in a certain direction, The same thing in China. The sea ebbs and flows. And if you have a treaty that is defined, it can create even more friction. And suddenly the treaty is seen not only as irrelevant, but seen as an impediment. And then people will want to break the treaty. But if you don't have a treaty and you operate on the premise of this is a mutually beneficial relationship without definition, you can ride through these storms in a better way. And when you have nations like Russia and Iran that have a history, when nations like Russia and China that have a history, treaties would probably be the last thing that you would want. That I think that when you, as long as you have this open-ended notion that we are on the same side, we are aligned, we have common interests, you don't need a treaty, for instance, if you are all working in good faith as part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, because that is sort of a treaty vehicle. You don't need a treaty if you're building institutions within the framework of the BRICS Forum, because those are, in many ways, treaties. By engaging these forums, you create greater flexibility because there's more potential for adaptation based upon the current situation in these forums than there is if you've strictly defined everything in a written treaty document that's bilateral in nature. So I disagree with Mr. Roberts. I think that actually Russia, China, and Iran are better served by not having treaties. Look what they've done. I mean, the Iranian support for Russia was critical, I think, and the Russian appreciation of what Iran did for Russia at a critical time when they needed these drones to help defeat, multi-billion-dollar air defense systems that were put in by the West. Iran stepped up to the plate and delivered the goods. When Russia needed China to open up its economy, to take a hit, actually economically, where China could have done things from an energy perspective that might have been in its own best interest, but they needed China to open up and bring in Russian energy when it may not have been convenient to do so, and then China to put pressure on other nations to also open up for energy. That was something that, a treaty may not have helped facilitate properly, but having this open-ended relationship, it's as Putin and Xi have said, it's stronger than any treaty.
We know that in Georgia, there is some sort of color revolution going on in Georgia. Do you think, are we going to have the same situation in 2014 as we had in Ukraine? Are we going to have the same, something similar in Georgia? And what they're doing there, in your opinion?
The West wants the same situation. What they're trying to provoke in Tbilisi, Georgia right now is a Maidan-like scenario that has a massive popular unrest, unseat a constitutionally elected government. The United States and the European Union have been trying to get Georgia out of the Russian orbit for some time now. In 2008, the United States and NATO extended a membership possibility to Georgia. And the European Union and Georgia have been working on Georgia becoming a member of the European Union. They've put these two, carrots out there to lure Georgia away from Russia. In 2012, in 2004, there was a color revolution. It was a George Soros-backed revolution, the Rose Revolution, that brought Mikhail Saakashvili into power. And he governed for 8 years. In 2008, he got Georgia involved in a disastrous conflict with Russia over South Ossetia. Humiliating defeat for the Georgians. And after that, he increasingly became more autocratic until the point where he was abusing his power. And in 2012, he was voted out of office and then hounded out of Georgia as a criminal. They accused him of violating human rights. Today, he has been brought back. He's been imprisoned. And this is a big thing. The opposition party that he once headed, that was once the ruling party, is demanding his release. The current governing party, the Georgia Dream Party, came to power in 2012, sort of the brainchild of a Georgian billionaire businessman, Bidzina Ivanishvili, who made his billions in Russian banking and Russian metals trading in the 1990s, especially. Ivanishvili came back in and he ousted, he helped oust Mikhail Saakashvili. And then he sort of backed away and he was playing behind the scenes movie, the Georgian Dream Party, the prime minister became other people besides Bidzina Ivanishvili. But their goal has been to salvage relations with Russia, not to break away from Russia. They still claim to want to be a member of the European Union, NATO, but I think the Georgia Dream Party understood that neither NATO nor Georgia Dream or nor the European Union were ever serious about Georgia joining. I mean, just think about it on the surface. They can't join NATO because of the Abkhazian and South Ossetian problems. And until they're willing to resolve those, they can't join. They can't resolve those unless they tell the Russians, who are sort of in control of those two policies, that they won't join NATO. So it's one of these catch-22s, the same in South Ossetia. The European Union says they want them to join, but Georgia would have to do a complete cultural transformation away from conservative Georgian society to traditional values, which are not conducive for homosexuality or transgendered persons. Georgia's not willing to make that transition, so to speak. So you have a problem. In 2021, the U.S. government began and the European Union began a policy of trying to carry out another soft power coup against Georgia, a dream, flooding Georgia with money to create political parties, to create non-governmental organizations, to create social movement organizations that would transform Georgia into a EU clone. In 2022, this effort took on an additional urgency because they wanted Georgia to join in the sanctioning of Russia, and they wanted Georgia to, later in 2023, to open up a second front against Russia. And the Georgia Dream Party said this is insane. But to show you how the Georgia Dream Party's right on this, while the European Union's collective economy is in shrink mode, with Germany, suffering greatly, deindustrialization, and things of that nature, since 2022, by maintaining close economic relations with Russia, Georgia's economy has grown by more than 10% each year. That's sort of a good thing, unless you're somebody who says, well, we can't have that because then, we'll never achieve our greater objective, which isn't to help Georgia, it's to use Georgia to create a second front against Russia. 2023, the Georgian Dream government, to counter this, proposed what's called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. There's the equivalent of, they call it the, they have a different name for it, foreign involvement law or investment law or something of that nature. But the bottom line is, if you're a non-governmental organization or a social movement organization, and you receive more than 20% of your funding from foreign sources, you have to declare it. You have to register as a foreign agent. And this is important because many of these places are totally funded by foreign entities, including the National Endowment for Democracy, the German Marshall Fund, and the European Economic Development Fund, all of which are soft power regime change type organizations.
Is that foreign interference?
It's 100% foreign interference. If it happened anywhere, I mean, imagine, if you would, a scenario where Russia said, we're going to form a couple non-governmental organizations in the United States, pour in $100 million for the sole purpose of undermining the Democratic and Republican parties to get a new political party and change the policy of the United States to be 100% behind Russia. But don't worry about it. It's democracy. Americans would go, pound sand. You ain't doing that. You can't bring in that. So, the Georgian Dream said, no, we want transparency. And knowing that the majority of the Georgian people, once they became aware of who was paying for all this, would say, well, wait a minute, who do you serve, Georgia or the Foreign Service? And so the people that were being paid, they didn't want this law. Now, the United States has the law, But in America, it's democratic, apparently. But in Georgia, to do it, it's undemocratic. It's the Russian law. The same thing with the European Union, same thing with Canada, same thing with, most countries. You don't allow foreign entities to buy their way into your politics. Last year, 2023, there were major demonstrations in the streets, and the Georgian Dream Party wasn't prepared for it. And so they backed down. They withdrew the law. This time, they're prepared for it. They've thought through, they've done their research, they know what the West is trying to achieve. They know that the West is trying to promote a Maidan revolution in Georgia. And so this time, the Georgia Dream Party passed it and then were prepared for the demonstrations. They broke up the demonstrations and they've matched the escalation. And the idea is not to allow a Maidan to occur, to keep this thing controlled, contained, to stay one step ahead of them. And you're starting to hear the panic in the voices of these people on social media. I follow many of them on Twitter. I follow X. I follow them on Telegram. And there's more and more panic as they realize that Georgia Dream is out has outsmarted them. The Georgia Dream is the better chess player here, that they've anticipated every move. But we're still heading down a path that could lead to violence. I mean, just take a look at what happened around April 30th, I believe, on the Georgian Armed Forces Day, celebrating the 33rd anniversary of the creation of the Georgian Armed Forces. Both the president of Georgia, a French diplomat named Salome, I can't remember exactly what her last name is, and then the prime minister, whose first name is Irakli, and I would butcher his last name if I said it, so I apologize. But they gave statements, they made addresses, and the president, who is the commander in chief, even though the presidency is largely a symbolic, position, she, turned to these troops who are American trained, American equipped, and she said, "Never forget who trained you. Never forget who made you be. When you are called upon to defend the Georgian nation from the enemies of Georgia." And the enemies of Georgia is Georgian Dream, the prime minister standing right next to her. She just told the military they need to rise up and go against the elected government of Georgia. So he came on next and he thanked everybody but her. He didn't mention her by name. He said, "There's one who I didn't mention by name because she is a traitor who has committed treason." So the prime minister in front of the Georgian army called the president a traitor who committed treason. This is not normal. This is very, very dangerous. And as the opposition tries to create the conditions of the Maidan, right now we have a situation where there's a Georgian movement that is defined by a symbol of a Molotov cocktail that's linked to a story from last year where somebody threw a Molotov cocktail, the first use of an incendiary device in a protest. And they're glorifying it. The entire movement is paid for by the National Endowment for Democracy. Okay, this is an entity created in the 1980s by the United States Congress to take activities, political action activities that were normally the purview of CIA covert operations, and to move them out of the CIA into a more overt fashion, but to achieve the same policies. So basically, it's doing the work of the CIA, regime change work of the CIA, without the CIA letters attached to its name formally. The CIA, of course, is behind the scenes working the way the CIA always does. But you have the United States government now glorifying the use of Molotov cocktails as an element of civic resistance. This is the same government that's putting everybody in jail for January 6th, where no Molotov cocktails were thrown. It's crazy what America is doing here. We are promoting civil war that will destroy. Georgia is a very tiny nation, 3.5 million people. And we're encouraging them to engage in a civil war. And if the American side wins, then we're encouraging them to open up a second front against Russia, which would lead to the total destruction of Georgia. America is not prepared to send troops to help Georgia. America will never send troops to help Georgia. We proved that in 2008 after Condoleezza Rice put pressure on then President Mikhail Saakashvili to invade South Ossetia. He did so with the Georgian army trained by the Americans. And 4 days later, the Russians totally defeated that army and actually moved in and occupied part of Georgia, threatened to capture Tbilisi. Georgia can't win against Russia, won't win against Russia. And we know this, but we are hoping that it will be enough to distract Russia so that Ukraine can recover. Now, if you're a Georgian, you have to ask yourself, we have a Georgia dream government that's giving us 10% economic growth every year. We're not at war. Things are okay. And what does the United States want us to do? Join into sanctions that will destroy our economy. And everybody admits that it'll destroy the Georgian economy. To open up a second front with Russia that will result in our total destruction as a nation within a week. Is that a friend? And the answer is no. America is not Georgia's friend, the European Union. Georgia will never be a member of NATO. Georgia will never be a member of the European Union. And both NATO and the European Union know this, but they're lying to the Georgians. They're misleading the Georgians. They're bribing the Georgians. They're pouring in hundreds of millions of dollars to win over the youth of Georgia, who are being trained that life is about receiving free money from foreign interests so that you can drink lattes in a cafe while plotting revolution. That's not how reality works.